Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And Joe at RT.ie, just another warning. The first story is a very disturbing story about a 12-year-old girl. I'm very conscious and that it's a difficult story to listen to. And I would rather, it's your own judgment, I'd rather that 12-year-olds did not hear it without their parents having heard it first. There may be lessons in it, but I'm just asking you to think about that over the next few minutes, especially if you're with 12-year-olds. It'll be available on the podcast later on. We have Niamh on the line. We've Niamh's father on the line, Barry. And we're talking about, these are not their names, obviously. We're talking about Sarah, who is Niamh's daughter, Barry's granddaughter. She's 12 years of age. Niamh, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. Do you want to begin on Saturday, the 26th of February, Niamh, and what happened? You've three children, your husband, three children, and what happened in your home with your 12-year-old daughter?
Okay. So basically, my daughter, she became very heightened, and she was having really bad meltdowns, as she would normally have. This has been nothing new, but she just got extreme. She has suicidal ideation, as that comes part and parcel with her Asperger's. But she became so heightened, she started to self-harm. Which I'm used to. She'd stab herself in her legs with forks and with keys, with CDs, with CD covers, anything that the poor child can find. She just becomes so heightened so quickly. I was doing everything I could to restrain her and take away all the harm out of her reach, but it just wasn't happening. I had to get all the razors, you know, everything away from her reach. Yeah. And as I was doing that, she got access downstairs to her own medication and took her own medication. So we were trying to, myself and my husband, were trying to keep her out of the kitchen. She became more heightened and became so aggressive. She was bashing her head off the walls. She pulls chunks of hairs out of her head. She doesn't seem to feel any pain during all this. So she was getting more heightened. She was kicking in the doors. She was punching in the door to try to get access into the kitchen. She just kept screaming. She wanted to die. She wanted to die. As we were trying to stop her, she became more agitated with us. Now she was hitting us and hitting out us. And it was so hard to try protect ourselves, try to restrain her, try to, you know, keep the whole thing managed. But she then started to threaten that she was going to kill us. And God love her, of all the years, you know, we've obviously been beaten up and things like that because she doesn't be right when she takes these episodes. But she never ever threatened that she was going to kill us, and she was just gone. I've tried to explain it for years that doesn't be my daughter standing in front of me in these episodes. So things got really, really scary. We had to lock our run out and lock my two younger girls out in the front garden. To keep them safe, and they're out there looking through a window at what's going on. They're only age 4 and 7, and they're screaming and crying through the windows. And so, long story short, we were really struggling to keep her managed, and we were really I was never so scared in all my life. I really thought, I said, we're not going to be able to hold her back, as one of us is going to come out of here in a body bag today. So I rang the guards. And I explained what was going on, and they were saying, you know, listen, there's nothing we can really do there to help. You're going to need to contact your GP to get her committed. So I rang the GP. Obviously, they're out the door. You have to wait on a phone call back from them. In the meantime, we have support worker with Tusla. So I rang that number, and I spoke to support worker, and there was nothing she could do either. Just try talk to her and calm her down, which didn't work. So I explained on the phone to the Tuzla worker. I said, listen, I said, this is so serious. I said, one of us is going to be killed here. I'm not going to watch her kill herself, and I can't stand back and have one of us being killed. I said, about the two kids being outside. So it was, you know, explained to me that I would be, I told her, I said, listen, I'm going to have to take all the dangerous objects out of the house, and I'm going to have to just run. I said, because no one is coming to help us. So I was advised, you know, that I'd be, you know, putting, you know, a child protection safety issue. And I said, I understand that. I said, but you're not understanding, you know, everyone I'm ringing, no one can help me, and someone's going to be murdered. So I ran, got all the knives, got all everything sharp, everything, all the medication, everything that I could think of. And I, we took the two kids and we had to leg it out of the house. As I left, I rang and reported myself to Tuzla. It was the out of hours service at this time. And I got through to the number, and I told her I was after abandoned a child, and it was my child. And I said, she really needs help. Someone needs to get up there quickly and help her. And she told me that I was actually through to the wrong area, that they were based down in Aces, nothing got to do with them, because it wasn't our area. So I just couldn't believe that, and I hung up. And then I reported as well to the guards. So
and your wording was, and we're calling your daughter Sarah, the wording was about Sarah when you spoke to the guards. You said, my daughter Sarah is on her own in the house. I know you used the phrase earlier, I've abandoned my child. Did you say the same to them?
And they actually said that we were after sending a car out to the house, because two slid at work was after making a phone call.
Okay.
So I was gone, I say I was gone about an hour and a half, and I went up. I was panicking because Sarah doesn't look like she has any disabilities. You know, as I said, she's high functioning. So I was frightened if she had have been out of fear, attacked one of the guards. So I got back up to the house, and the guards were actually there. And they were lovely. They were so nice. Right. They were so understanding. They were so empathetic, but they were also very concerned. They see in the back of the car that my two smaller girls were sitting in with a bag full of knives and tools and, you know, everything, all sharps, all the medication. And, you know, they're looking, going, that's awful. This is horrible that we're looking at them two kids there, another child that's after being left in the house, you know. And I explained, I said, I'm mortified. Like, the whole road without looking. And I said, I'm not trying to do this just because I just wanted to go off and, you know, have a break. I cried, you know.
Where was Sarah at this stage, Niamh?
She was standing at the door. And very upset. Now, wasn't as heightened as she was in the house. She was after calm. As I said, she was after taking, she's on treatment of antidepressants and antipsychotics since a small age to try help her her moods. But they kind of could make it a bit sleepy. So she medicated herself. Obviously, she didn't take a dangerous amount, but they kind of made her a bit, you know, sleepy. So she was calming. But the guards were here for, I'd say, about 2 hours, and they were really concerned. And one of them, actually, the only option that he had, he said, listen, he said, we can't leave. He said, these are all at too much of a high risk here. So he was after getting on to the sergeant, and they said that they didn't want to have to come to this at all. But the only way was to detain Sarah under the Mental Health Act. And they explained what that meant was going to have to, you know, take her out of the house, remove her, even if she was resisting and stuff like that. And she'd have to be brought to the station to be assessed by one of their GPs and then brought over to the hospital, where they haven't got a psychiatric children's unit, where I've been for years. And they said that they just discharge her and send her home anyway. So I begged and cried, I said, please, please, you can't do that. I said, she's calm there now. She'll end up, she'll have a heart attack if you do this to her, you know. So they were trying their best. They were being so good. They really were. And they were, I think they were on the phone to Tuzla, emergency hours. But in that time, I'd rang my dad's and I was sobbing. I was like, you know, they're going to take her over to the police station. He was actually recovering from COVID. He was on antibiotics and steroids. He was very, very ill. And he flew up the road as soon as he heard. And it was only for him that she didn't get to go through that trauma. But he made it clear on the phone to Tusla and the guards that night that this was only, you know, as an emergency, that she needed help, she needed her placement, that he can't keep her safe either.
She's still down there today, so I hope that.
And is Barry your grand? Is he your father or your husband's father?
My father.
Your father, okay, because he's on the other line. That's where Sarah is now. Stay with us, Niamh. Yeah. It's a horrific, horrific situation you're in. Barry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And how are you? How's Sarah today?
She's quiet as such, but again, you know, I was trying to get her to do a Zoom call for school, and that was total no-no. There's a girl comes out from Realty, or from one of the services to help getting her dressed and all, and she was just in a bit of defiance for that now. It's kind of manageable, but you know, again, you can see something's brewing, and maybe in the next course of the next day or two, something will rear its head. She'll take a meltdown, you know. And what I do is I try just keep things level for as long as I can. But you know, there's very little I can do, and it's very unpredictable too. She is only 12 since last Friday.
Okay.
But she looks between 14 or 15.
Okay.
Very big girl.
Yeah.
Very strong. Yeah. And when she takes these meltdowns, you know, it's like somebody after taking drugs or something. Her face contorts, and she gets this huge strength where she ends up hitting herself and damaging herself and hitting her head off walls. And it's very distressing to look at a 12-year-old. Saying she wants to damage herself, you know.
And from Friday evening, Barry, when you stepped in, how was Sarah over the weekend, and how were you over the weekend?
Pretty wore out. As I said, it's a full time job to look after her, to keep her in a kind of a happy place. It's a real one to one thing to keep her in a happy place. And I've been with her now the last 4 years, so I've been by myself. And all of a sudden, I have this 12-year-old, and it's a bit of a shock to the system. Plus, I'm only after getting over the COVID.
Yeah, so.
But it's tough. It's tough, and I know my daughter is struggling too to keep things happy and keep things going. But it really is it's a full time job, and as I said, for me myself now, I don't know how she does it with two other little smaller kids. Because it is totally one to one, what you have to do with her, you know.
Niamh, what help has Sarah got before that even worked to some extent? Or did it work to any extent?
Well, basically, she as I said, she got diagnosed in 2014, and they'd been that was with CAMHS, and they've been so supportive to us. And she's on medication, so that was kind of as she got put on medication. I'm trying to think. I think she was about 5 or 6. She was only in senior infants, and she tried to hang herself.
Yeah. We won't go into that.
And children's films. Sorry. They had to put her on medication for that. Then things got worse. So long story short, there was nowhere that could help her. I went absolutely everywhere where to go to. I went to all the hospitals I went to the playhouse, every single body I went to try to get her help. Long story short, back in 2018, I had to abandon her in telehospital and refuse to take her out until we got help, that we got intervention and to try help her be manageable and be able to live a stable life. So she was placed into a respite home indefinitely. And It was as a result of me. I actually ended up in a mental health hospital myself from all the fighting and all the struggling. I was in there for 3 months myself. So she ended up in that care, and they brought her on amazingly. They were giving her help, but it was shown that she needed a more suitable living arrangement. That it was torn, it was working out, it was too hard on them, and it wasn't the right placement for her. But that's what was bringing her on, and that was the only thing that was working for her. But due to an issue I can't really go into, I made it's probably the biggest mistake in my life. I took her home in November. I took her out in November, and just as the issue was being resolved, so I thought she'd be going back there, or, you know, if it was going to be a different place or whatever, but that wasn't the case. The HSE haven't spoke to me, or they haven't dealt with me about it, and just been leaving her home since November, and it's been... Tuesday have been dealing with me. They've been very helpful. They're trying their best to support the family, but they have made it clear that they can't actually help her. They can't take her into any of their care settings, as it will actually make her worse and destroy her. She's not well. The child needs help with the disability settings, you know. But
and Niamh, have they put a name on, medically on a name on what Sarah's condition is?
No, well, she was diagnosed in, as I said, 2014 with Asperger syndrome. Okay. Then as years went on, they turned it into a multi-diagnosis. So it was Asperger's with PDA, pathological demand avoidance disorder, and ADHD. But with them, it means she has a clinically severe anxiety disorder and a clinically severe sensory processing disorder. So that's why she finds the day-to-day living so tough. She can't stand the noises. She can't stand touch. She can't stand smell. You know, when she was in that care setting, they gave me back a totally different child. You know, we were going through, life really was not worth living back then. And she was getting great help. And she was able to start, you know, they were helping her with her dressing, her hygiene, everything like that. You know, she was really coming on. But she needed the rest of the intervention. So all recommendations went in from all the professionals that she needed a residential setting.
And Niamh, would you be prepared to let her go back to that setting?
I'd be prepared to let her to go back to somewhere that can keep her safe, because as I was talking to producer and all, like, there's no hospital, there's nowhere to help you.
But she was here, but you took her out.
Of course, yeah. It's gonna push back at me. But all I can say is, you know, I was trying to just act the whole lot. But the whole thing is, it was explained it was only to take her out while the issue was trying to be resolved. But that wasn't the case. She never got returned. And then it's just been going on deaf ear. You know, Tuzla are actually even trying to get help as well. But they, I rang, I told the dangers. Only on Sunday night, she had another meltdown, God help her. And she, again, in my dad's bashing her head off the walls. And, you know, we were ringing neighbours and seeing, can anyone help us and stuff. We had to call an ambulance because she just kept screaming, she wants to die. And she's, you know, she really, if she had something in front of her to do it, she would do it. These aren't cries for help, because we used to be told that's only a cry for help. And then it was when the respite actually saying, oh God, no, these aren't cry for help. You know, she really is going to hurt herself, you know.
And Barry, you must be worried just thinking of this evening, tomorrow, the weekend. How do you cope? Is Barry still there? How do you cope with that prospect, Barry? Are you still there? Oh, Barry's gone, of course. Oh, okay, we'll get Barry back, hopefully, after this break. 51551 is the text number. Wash your hands.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Talking to Niamh, who has contacted us because she's at her wit's end, as you would have heard her explain. Her daughter Sarah is 12 and has extreme mental health difficulties, behavioural, self-harming, and indeed poses a danger to others. It came to a head last Friday, last Friday was her 12th birthday. Barry, who is Niamh's father and Sarah's grandfather, stepped in, and he's currently has Sarah in his home, but obviously the family needs a permanent home in a residential setting. Barry, sorry, the point I was trying to make was that, like, you're worried about, you've had Sarah now since last Friday, 5 days. But do you worry about this evening, tomorrow, the weekend?
I do, because she's unpredictable and she's impulsive. You know, I couldn't predict and say, she's going to have a meltdown tonight. You do know when something's coming, all right, but it may take a week for that to come through, but it she'll just kick off, and it could be over the slightest little thing rather than a big thing, you know?
Yeah, I understand.
She should have been on the Zoom call this morning for school, but there's no way was she tolerating it.
Okay.
And, you know, I had to give in and say, okay, well, then just forget about it. You know, we can't. There's no point in having her blown up over it, you know, and she would attempt to hurt herself. Then it's just very, very awkward. You know, what do I do with her 12 years of age? Hold her down, tie her down? I don't know. I'm not with the end over her. Distressing. It's very distressing to watch. You see a young girl hitting her head against the wall.
Niamh, there's a statement in from Tusla, but it doesn't really say anything. Tusla doesn't discuss the specific details of individual cases in the public domain. We understand that, but and there's lines after that. Mental health services are provided by our colleagues in the HSE. Tusla does advocate for children and young people in our care, but you want your daughter to go into the care of Tusla.
No, it's not Tusla I wanted to go into. It's with the HSE Disability Services. That's who been with.
Okay.
So it's basically what happens. Like Tusla was never supposed to be the duty of care.
You've enough on your shoulders.
Oh, sorry. But they were never, ever meant to be. But it's been the HSE Disability who has thrown it all onto Tusla for funding. They've just been trying to push. This is the whole problem. She's been passed. It's a game of pass to parcel. So basically, I'm wanting her to go in. I actually emailed the HSC only last week. Sarah is actually down in my dad's 2 weeks now, nearly.
Okay, since Friday
and
week.
And it was like... Yeah, sorry, yeah. I think it was the 26th or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But it was when she took that meltdown on the Sunday. Again, I had to cancel the ambulance because they were going to have to come with the guards. And I can't put her through that. I can't stand there and watch. She's not a criminal. She's not a monster. She's a scared little child who has so much. Oh, she has so much to give and she has so much to live for, but just can't see that right now when she needs that help as she was promised from the HSE Disability Services. But it's them that's failing to give her the care. It's them that, when I emailed to say, listen, she's after having another meltdown, I said, you know, I'm watching my child slowly die in front of my eyes. I said, my dad is going to have a heart attack from the stress. I said, you'd have to put her into an emergency respite bed while they're planning what's going on. Because at the minute, the fight is whether she belongs in with Tusla or whether she belongs in with a residential setting with HSE. Everyone is fighting for her to go on to the disability HSE side, but it's just the HSE going against it. But anyway, their response was that there is no emergency respite beds. But that's what broke me, because while Sarah was in respite care for 2 years, we were doing a shared care arrangement, but she was also sent home as other emergencies were sent in. And there was one time that I said, please, you know, I can't take her back. There was, you know, child protection issues from my two smaller daughters. And her clothes were left in the black sack at the door and her medication left down in the local chemist for me to collect. And, you know, that's the way she's been treated. But yet when I'm crying out for this help for her, like, what do? The hospital turned me away. They actually told me and my dad, this hospital for sick children, we're really sorry, we can't help you. There's nothing we can do for her. I went to the adolescent children hospital in Derry. They couldn't do anything for her either, which I, you know, I'm not angry. I'm not blaming any of these people because they were trying to protect her to say, listen, she's not at a stage where she was doing a certain, you know, suicidal attempt, but she was going to be exposed to that within the hospital setting. And my last kind of, I suppose, hope was getting her into another mental health hospital for children. And I got a letter the other day to say they can't take her in there because she's too violent and too aggressive. Mm-hmm. And they can't even handle her. They basically said it in black and white that they wouldn't be able to manage her. So there's literally nothing. There's nothing. I'm sitting back. We're sitting back and watching this child slip away. Mm-hmm. She is going to do something. She is going to, and I've been crying and saying it, and they're not going to. I said it. It's like, I watched me ma's, my dad said there, you know, she'd be gone 4 years this year, and I swore that, Jesus, this has been the most traumatic thing I've been through in my life, watching my mum slip away. Mm. And God forgive me, it was a walk in the park compared to what we're living day in, day out to try get this child help. Okay. But she doesn't deserve this life. No one deserves this life.
Edward is on the line, 1850 715 815. Joe with RT.ie. Edward, good afternoon. You're listening to Niamh and Barry talking about Sarah.
I am, Joe. Good afternoon.
Yeah, your situation.
First of all, my heart goes out to that family. Yeah. We're going through the very same thing with our son. Now, he's currently away. He was taken away. It would have been a week Monday. Mm. And he was to come back to us. And he had so many meltdowns up there that they held on to him. Mm. That he's unsafe to let home. But it's just a ringing, Joe, and it's the services are not there. Yeah. You know, and it's basically down to the services.
And how did it come to your son being removed recently from the house?
He actually landed his mother in hospital, and then the social services, obviously when that happened, that's when they sort of kicked into gear then, and they had no choice. I was in work when it happened.
And he's 14?
14, yeah.
How is your wife?
She's in bits at the minute because she misses him terrible. Like, she wants him home, but we want our son home, not... I don't mean to say the demon, but the demon that does be in him, it's not his fault.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
He's in... I don't want to name it, obviously, but he's in a residential unit now, is he, Edward?
He's in a residential unit at the minute, emergency residential.
And is that under the auspices of TUSTA or the HSE, or...?
We got it through the HSE.
Okay.
But there's respite. The respite that my son is waiting, and he's on the waiting list for 4 years. 4 years, Joe.
Yeah.
And at the minute, that respite house, I won't say where it is, but that's actually closed down because of COVID. Yet where my son is at the minute, they're well able to stay open.
Yeah.
They're well able to man it and staff it. You know. Now, we the guards, like that poor girl...
Niamh, yeah.
We had the guards down several times. My son broke windows in the house. Now, to look at him, Joe, if I walked him into your studio this evening, you'd say, "We got Edward, you're mad. What are you talking about?"
Yeah.
He has no... Do you know what I mean? Now, that girl can probably relate to what I'm saying. Maybe it's a different...
100%.
And Edward, how was your boy after the episodes?
Well, she just be wore out. A shower. She used to go for a shower straight away.
Jesus.
And we'd be up to 90. You know.
Mm.
And he will apologise. He always apologises. And it's like as if when he hits a certain gear, it's like as if he doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
And that, and we've highlighted this with the HSE and the staff that's working with us. But look, it fell on deaf ears for a long time, and it took all this now this year. Now look, the COVID is not helping. He's out of school.
Yeah,
he goes to a special school.
Yeah.
He doesn't go into mainstream. But it took it to get serious before we got help. And at the minute, we don't sort of know what help we're going to get out of this. We're looking for a lot of psychology, child psychology.
Yeah.
And we've been told, but your son won't go in and sit down in an office. I said, I understand that, but they can be done through play therapy and this, that and the other. There's several ways of doing psychology.
And Niamh, can I ask you the same question about Sarah? How is she after the episodes?
Exactly, like Ed was actually been talking about, it's basically like talking about the same child. Now she won't take the showers. She's the opposite. She'll go out in the rain. Mm. She'd go out in the nude in the rain if she could, but hates taking showers at baths. But she does be exhausted. And as I said, when she goes into these modes, she's gone. It's your child in front of you. You know, if I can try to explain it right, but they're gone.
Yeah, but Niamh, afterwards, is Sarah aware of where she's been and what she's done?
Yeah, she just be exhausted. And then she just either, if she doesn't go to sleep, she will cry and cry and cry her heart out and beg and say, please, is there an operation to help me? I don't want to be like this. Please make this stop. Please, mammy. And she'd beg and she'd be begging me dad and saying, granddad, help me, help me. She's screaming through this, saying, help me, help me. And then afterwards she's crying, saying, I don't want to hurt myself. I don't want to hurt yous. I just want to. And she'd just say it over and over, God help her. She'd say, mammy, I would rather go to heaven than having to live like this. It's absolutely, it's something I'll honest to God, I will go to my grave haunted by what we have all had to witness. And so what they're doing to her, what's actually doing to her little head, what hope has she got to come on when she's being damaged? And it's not even like the episodes now are kind of, it's only once a week or whatever. This is her day-to-day life that she feels, it's almost like a release. When she hurts herself, she gets a release from it. Mm-hmm. And it's a horrible way to explain it, but that's what happens to her. And then after it, God help her, she is so frightened and so scared of herself. And she's so afraid then what's going to happen. You know, it's...
And Edward, in your case, the same question, is your son, does he know is he conscious the way Sarah is of what's gone on?
To a certain level, Joe, he would. But when he hits the 100 mark, as we do call it, I don't think he actually remembers the full extent of what he's after doing. Like, my son would put his head through a concrete wall. His pain threshold is through the roof. He does not feel pain as we would. And we've tried to hold him. We've been bitten, slapped, hair pulled, kicked, you know. And as I said, my wife now, she got a kick under the chin and nearly fractured her jaw. It wasn't my son's fault, it was his disability.
But was he aware afterwards that that his mom had ended up in hospital because of an attack?
He was.
And what did he say? Was he emotionally, how did he deal with that?
He apologised, but the funny thing was, Joe, the following day, when he went into another one of these rages, he said, do you want me to do it again?
Mm-hmm.
So it was like as if, like, we were sort of shocked from that now.
What do you mean? Do you want me to do what again? Sorry, apologise or...
No, do you want me to come over here and I'll give you another box in the jaw or what, you know? But it's only when he's in... Now, look, as I said, the town where we live in, everyone knows him. And has great time for him.
Great.
And but lately now he's doing a lot of running away from the home.
Okay.
And he's jumping out in front of cars and this, that and the other. The guards are well aware of him, you know.
Yeah.
And now, in fairness to the guards here, they have been brilliant.
Yeah.
They've come down anytime we've rang them. They'll go up, they'll have a little chat with him in his room. Now, I had to put in a padded room upstairs.
Okay.
I had to perspex the window because before the Christmas there, he pulled the length of skirting board off the room and drove it straight out through the window. And you couldn't enter the room then if he had hang in his hand like that.
Yeah.
It's just not safe for... And we've a younger daughter as well. Yeah. She's 11.
So what's the plan, Edward, insofar as you know? He's in this residential setting after, and that happened after he unfortunately assaulted his mother and she ended up in hospital. But what is the plan?
Well, the plan now is the medication that my son was on, we and the doctors have weaned him down off of that. But things got so bad in the residential where he is now. His own psychiatric doctor is after prescribing him new medication. Now, he's due home to us probably Sunday or Monday. And we'll just have to carry on from there and just hopefully this medication might be the one. Maybe it doesn't. If not, we're back to square one. So the plan at the moment, Joe, is just up in the air. We just every day, it's not even day, it's every minute by minute.
Does Barry want to come back in? Barry, you okay? I'm conscious that
you're... it's mirrored. It's almost a mirror.
Yeah.
Chloe gets it, or...
Sarah, yeah.
Gets into these terrible rages and, you know, she'll apologise afterwards, but she'll probably do it again the next day.
Yeah.
Or the next meltdown. As I said, it's unpredictable. But that's hitting her head and all that. She uncontrollable strength she gets. She has no pain threshold. Or she'd stab herself with forks into the leg and Edward there, he's speaking. It's like a mirror.
Maybe the same now, Joe. We've all sharp objects. They're all up at the higher units in our house. And it's for our safety, but more it's for his own safety.
Edward, given that it's helpful even as Barry said there to hear you, and I hope vice versa, even in terms of we're not alone. But is there a support group, Edward or Niamh or Barry? Have you come across a family group, a family support group that might help just even in conversations like this?
Obviously, you know, there's lots, especially, you know, up here in Dublin, there's a loads there on Facebook and everything like that. And there's a lot of parents that you talk to. And, you know, like that, it's so good to be able to just have a vent and just have someone to understand you. But it's also a bit of a harsh reality as well, because you're listening to other parents who are going through the same thing. And they're no further to getting help either. And then you're looking at parents who have gone through worse and awful stuff. And you're looking going, oh my God, sometimes it can make you more panicked about what's the future going to hold for you and what's the future going to hold for your child.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Edward, kind regards to you and your family. Your wife, I presume, is out of hospital from what you're telling me.
It's still
a terrible, shock apart from anything else. But
siblings as well, though, Joe. A lot of support. Like they don't think of the siblings. Like our little one is 11 now, and look, she's a star.
Yeah.
And but she has seen and witnessed. She should never. Now, my little one got support about 3 years ago for about 3 hours one morning in sort of like a little art class with other siblings from the same background.
Yeah.
3 hours in the last 3 years she was offered, and that's meant to be great. You know, I mean, like, they have to think of the siblings as well as regards to their mental health.
But as you say, an average of an hour a year. 3 hours, 3 years. Michelle is on the line, Joe at RT.ie. Michelle, your daughter is 10.
That's right.
And what's the situation?
Very much like your other callers. She has a diagnosis of Asperger's, a PDA profile, which is the pathological demand avoidance. She has sensory processing and OCD behaviours.
Okay.
So she's been assessed at 5 and we've had no intervention. And her behaviours and anxieties and stresses, very like your other callers, are just getting worse and worse as she gets older.
So she's been diagnosed at 5. She's now 10.
Yeah, yeah. Now, she had, when she was 5, she was diagnosed with a severe learning disability and dyslexia. But I knew from the time she was born there was something wrong, and I tried to get lots of help for her through the GP, through the HSC, and then she was eventually, because I couldn't get through to anybody, she was diagnosed with Asperger's through the Lucina clinic, referred from our GP. But no interventions, despite her being on waiting lists for years.
And Michelle, can I ask you how she shows her anxiety? Anyway, you tell me. I won't put words.
What she does is, in her meltdowns, very much like the other kids we're talking about, she kind of, it's like nearly an outer body experience. She doesn't remember a lot of what's happened if she's at that level, maximum level. She gets quite aggressive. And she lashes out, obviously, she has a little brother, so she lashes out on him. So, I'm a single mom. So trying to help her and give my other child time is really difficult because she needs me 90% of the time.
Yeah.
You know, and no help for her. Despite lots of emails, lots of phone calls to every service or to anybody who could help, but no intervention.
Shocking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you describe, Michelle, I don't know, but it's in the call here, that the brushing of her hair.
Yeah, she brushes her hair so much that her head bleeds because of the sensory processing and the frustration in her. She kind of bangs herself and then starts hitting and kicking things and stuff like that. You know, it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And she's always remorseful afterwards.
Yes, she is. Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of the time she doesn't really remember to the extent of what actually happened.
Okay, that's just 3 calls in the space of 45 minutes telling. No two stories are the same, but they're very... Michelle, are you aware of any family groups? Have you any support?
No, there are there's support groups on Facebook. That's really about the size of it. I've had supports from Tusla, but they said that they weren't the service to provide any help. Bernardo's got involved. They weren't the service who could do anything. I'll be honest with you, I'm at the end of my tether now, you know, because I want my daughter to have the best possible life. She's an amazing little girl. She has so much to give in life, but she needs help to be her best self and happy self.
Okay. Niamh and I think Edward made a point that they are aware of other family support groups, but we will share that information once you're all agreeable after the programme.
Great.
So you can at least share your own resources that you've located, but that does not solve the problem or the challenge by any stretch. Niamh, thanks indeed. Kind regards to you, Barry, your family, and above all, Sarah, Edward, your boy, we call him Edward Jr. I know that's not your name either. And your wife especially, and your younger daughter, but above all,
if I could just put across, you mentioned the point there that all kids are different. One of them that has Asperger's, autism, any kids especially, they're all different. But the services is the same.
Okay.
And the services should be able to step up to the bar and provide the service that these kids and their families need, and their siblings. A lot of services do forget about their siblings.
Yeah, of course, that point as well.
You know.
Michelle as well. Thank you, Edward, and thank you, Michelle,
thanks,
and
Joe.
Kind regards
thank
to
you.
Your incredible little girl, as you call her. Thanks indeed. Joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And back to this case of Joe Marmion, a Jesuit priest. He was a Jesuit priest until he died, by the way, even though 23 years previously, in 1977, the Jesuits said they knew he was a criminal and a paedophile, but they moved him from different settings, ministering settings, by the way, including a hospital. In the meantime, and he was buried, the death notice said, quite clearly, deeply regretted by the Jesuit community. And he was buried in the Jesuit plot where he now lies at near the front gate there, as you go in the front gate of Glasnevin, it's up onto the far left, with the other religious orders that are all near the front of the cemetery. And more people are contacting us about this man and the fact that he was on the rampage for decades, and nobody seemed, until now in 2021, when, and you heard from him on Friday, when one victim insisted that the Jesuits name him publicly, which they did last Tuesday week, and that's when they revealed they knew about him since 1977. And the situation, the Jesuits, unfortunately, we've been unable to get any reaction to our questions we've asked over the last few days about the when and the Gardaí and various other things. The Jesuits have taken it, they've become the poor clerics, they've taken a vow of silence, I think, but that's too flippant a remark for such a serious, serious topic, as you're about to hear in some of the letters I'm going to read out and some of the people we're going to talk to. I'll begin with Andrew, who's in North America, while we still have the line. Andrew, I know it's good morning to you. Good afternoon from Ireland. Can you tell us of your experience? I'll try not to ask too many questions because of the delay. But can you tell us, Andrew, of your experiences with Father Joseph Marmion?
Yeah. He was just a creep. He was always a creep to me more than anything else. So I did end up in his singing class in first year. And he had us singing these... elocution was like a big part of his thing, as far as I was concerned, and I felt that he was trying to kind of drum the Dublin accent out of me. But anyway, I did end up in his operetta, and as other callers have described, I went through that hideous costume fitting exercise, and let's just say he had me try on tights, and I was 13 or something at the time, and he was just looking at me all lasciviously. He had this just creepy air about him all the time, like in his class, in his German class, you'd put your hand up to go to the bathroom, and he'd, just his voice, it was sickening. He'd say, I hope it comes out all right, in that sort of slimy tone.
Andrew, had you any idea what was... Because we've heard this MO, his modus operandi, he was big into music, running the musicals in Belvedere and Crescent and Clongowes, I think he was involved as well, that he would bring... We've heard of assaults, or him deriving some form of sexual gratification from bringing boys up to that costume room and getting them to undress completely.
Yeah, well, my own personal experience was that I was just so mortified with the whole thing. I never spoke to anyone about it. In fact, this is the first time I've ever spoken openly about it. I've told one or two people since the story has arisen. I've told a couple of people, personal friends, but that was the thing that was, looking back on it now, that is so infuriating, because it was well known among the boys, this guy was a creep, and there were, I wasn't mature enough at the time to know exactly the extent, we knew this guy was up to horrendous things, especially on these trips to Vienna, and we knew, I didn't hang out with the kids who went on those trips. They usually his top singers. They were the ones that we just kind of knew, without knowing the details, that they'd been subject to horrific things, things that we didn't even understand at that time, or at least I didn't anyway. But I mean, I can still picture one of those kids now, and my heart just goes out to what he had to go through in his life with that, you know. And this thing about Marmion being buried in a Jesuit plot, and the fact that he was never defrocked and handed over to the police, it's the enablers. I'm almost, I'd say equally disgusted, but there was enabling going on there. There was a culture that just allowed people like that to operate. And you know that, Joe. You've had phone-ins on all kinds of books like this. And it was in the culture. We were supposed to defer to these people. And they're supposed to be smarter than us. You know, he never impressed me with his smartness and his singing ability and all that. I hated the whole thing. I hated the operettas. I couldn't stand it. Dressing up in girls' clothes. I mean, as I said in the email to you, even that alone should have been a flag. Mm. I mean, that's just ridiculous in an all-boys school to have forcing little boys to get into girls' costumes. I mean, mother of divine. Excuse my language. But just, I mean, you can hate me now. I mean, it makes me emotional, you know, this is nearly 50 years ago. And it's not about what happened to me. It just makes me emotional that culture existed. And as I said to an email, I mean, just the contradictions rife in that institution, you know, that this was going on, and at the same time, you'd have, you know, there were good priests there. There were excellent priests there, you know, who taught us great things about social justice and everything. But to live in that contradiction was just, it's just a bizarre culture that they... And like I said, they were neighbours. They were priests. There was one of the stories I listened to, one of your callers, and I don't remember the gentleman's name, but he talked about a priest poking his head in the door while all this was going on.
Yeah, and that...
They knew. They just knew, you know? And we know that they knew. But, you know, and I don't know what justice looks like at this stage. I really don't. You know, so...
Okay, Andrew, take a breather. Stay with us. Before I go from North America from the States to further up to North America to Toronto, I'll read out one of the letters we got about Father Joe Marmion. Thank you for your interest in the events relating to Joe Marmion. I was a victim of his abuse. It was a fashion at the time among a certain group. It is amazing that these events have remained under wraps for all this time. But I, like many others, am middle class, and it is not in our DNA to go public or to rock the proverbial boat. I am now hopeful that the conduct of the Jesuits in the second half of the last century will come into the public domain. There is a shocking story that must be told, and I don't want to go to my grave with these secrets. We have too much experience to know that allowing the Jesuits to be judges in their own court fooled us before, and the clever offer, that's they've set up a helpline, etc. It's in their statement we read out numerous times last week, and their clever offer is not acceptable. My suggestion, and the purpose of this letter, is for an independent investigation. The nature of the investigation suggests that it should be chaired by a lawyer from the criminal branch. In order to establish total independence, the lawyer should be from outside this jurisdiction and not be of the Roman Catholic persuasion. If the Jesuits are genuinely seeking the truth, this will unearth it. All costs paid by the Jesuits, they are a very wealthy religious order. Maurice Stokes, we're talking about Father Joe Marmion, and we're now talking about the reaction of the Jesuits after they discovered he was a paedophile. By the way, you mentioned, Andrew, that German trip. We were sent in a report. I don't know what was it from the Belvedere Annual or whatever, about one of those German trips. Two things jumped out at me. One, this particular trip, I don't know what year it was, it doesn't say, this particular trip with Marmion lasted for 28 days. He was away with those group of 16 Belvederians for a month, effectively. And at the end, this young man who wrote the report, and was about the music and what they did for, obviously it was in the school annual, so there was nothing else in it, but it was about the music and the little trips they went on. This is the last paragraph. Father Marmion was our travel agent, guide, interpreter, teacher, musical advisor, spiritual guide and general manager. We were all deeply grateful to him for a wonderful holiday. Now, Maura Stokes, you were in Crescent College until your leaving cert in 1967, which is a full 10 years before the Jesuits say they got complaints about them. What were
you
your...
Are
right, Joe? Yeah, go ahead, Maurice. What was your experience with this father?
Okay, I'll be very brief, and I was listening to you, and I'll just... time is the most precious commodity in life. Thank you for your interest, and thank you. Very briefly, I attended Crescent from January 1960 to end of June 1967.
Okay.
And I was not involved in operettas or anything. I lived out in the country in Lisnagrine near in Castle Connell Parish.
Okay.
And I went by bus to school and came home by bus to school. So I had limited involvement after school. I only had Marmion for 2 years. I think he came to the school in 65. To the best of my knowledge, I had him for English in my final year.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote in the letter how he behaved. He did not obey school policies or procedures that they had. He liked to hit us and belt us and also roll up your pants and expose your knee and your tie, and he'd give you the 1-2. Barry McLaughlin told you about that.
Mm.
Anyways, I was sent to the office and to see the principal. I won't mention his name,
mm-hmm.
but he was called the prefect of studies. I felt that at the time that Marmion had him around his little finger. Anyway, the principal, he said, "I have complaints from Father Marmion, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Yeah." So I said to him, I gave him a piece of my mind about Marmion, and I gave him mm-hmm. a piece of my mind about him not giving me the right to explain myself. So he said, "Well, what I want you to do is close the door, take off your trousers and your underwear and expose your bare bottom, because I'm going to give you, I think it was 8 at the best, you know, with the pandy bat."
Yeah, yeah, the pandy bat.
I told him, "No way are you going to do that." I said, "No way." I said, and I said, "As far as I'm concerned, you're a pervert." Now, I didn't know anything about Marmion's paedophilia or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I opened the door and I banged it. And you know the rest, I explained it in my letter. For the remaining 6 to 8 weeks in that thing, neither Marmion nor the prefect of studies, I was never punished for that. I couldn't stand Marmion. I would very often not turn up for his class. And I told you I'd go down the docks and watch the ships loading and unloading. And I never told my parents, and they never knew about it.
Wow. But you...
But they had one last revenge, which I didn't mention. And that was when I went back to get a reference after doing my leaving cert,
mm-hmm.
My requests were ignored. So finally I demanded one, and I did get one from the prefect of studies. I showed it to my father, and you know his attitude. I write a check, they do their job, you know? So I said, "Look, I want you to read this." So he read it, and he got back to me in a few days, my father. He said, "I read the reference from the prefect of studies." He said, "That wouldn't get you a job as a jacks cleaner in Piccadilly Square in London."
Right.
I said, "I need a reference."
Yeah.
So he went, and he made an appointment, a rare appointment, and he went and saw the said prefect of studies. He explained to him, my father wasn't confrontational. He just said, my father was one of those polite dubs, you know.
Okay.
He said, "Look," he said, "my son needs to make a livelihood. And you know, he needs a piece of paper that will open doors for him. So please, can you do something?" So anyways, my father came back in a week and he got a reference. And it wasn't glowing, it wasn't mm-hmm. great, but at least it would open the door, you know?
Okay, and Maurice, this will go back. This is a 1960, just for, this is around 1967.
I remember it so well.
Yeah.
I remember it so well. This was in July 1967.
Okay.
I'd be 72 on Saturday, and I remember all this.
And Maurice,
it was making it very hard for me to apply for jobs college or anything. And this went on for a few weeks. Now, my father and mother's attitude was they were very pro the establishment, and they sort of behaved as if they were, and I'll say it out front, they behaved as if they were upper class, you know, and you don't betray the establishment, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyways, cut a long story short, and tell me to shut up if I'm going on.
Fine.
The thing was that with Marmion, he was out of control. But the point, the real reason I wrote to you was, here was I, and my father had been recovering from a very serious, he had a burst ulcer and nearly died, and had been out of action for months. And I didn't want to bother my parents anyway. They were hard to talk to about these things. But they are gone to the reward. But they never knew that I was absent without permission from the school, which is in violation of the Education Act. I was a bold boy. I took off.
And Morris, just and like Andrew, you had them.
Contacted them and complained.
Yeah. Amazing.
And I was left alone for the last 2 months. I was left alone by the Prefect of Studies and Marmion. Never bothered me, never said a word. They did have the last, throw of the card when I went to reference.
But, okay. But Morris did. But Morris, just...
I am amazed that why did they stay silent? Why was I not reported to my parents?
And Morris, when this incident, when you went to the Prefect, just to be clear, do you think the Prefect had already got complaints about Marmion or knew of his behaviour?
To be very honest with you, my immediate reaction was, I wasn't going to, you know, the only person I would take my pants down for would be the doctor in the, in the surgery, or a nurse in the hospital to get an injection or something, you know? Yeah. But for a priest, this was disrespectful. And by the way, one of my former students mentioned that we would be invited for spiritual guidance. It was part of the school system. And we go, the priest's bedrooms were just around the corner.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I never thought about that. But anyway, this was in the principal's office.
Okay.
But my reaction to him was, when I called him a pervert, I know I shouldn't have done that. But the point was, I had no idea that Marmion was a paedophile. I had no idea. But for the remaining 2 months, when I didn't turn up for class, and I knew if my parents had heard anything, they would have let me know, particularly my mother.
Okay.
But she was very pro-Jesuit. And I said to myself, and I'm going to say, what the F is going on here?
And
I was very insecure and rather shy, and I wasn't always the best behaved. I don't deny that. I had my own challenges, and which was anxiety. I didn't know then. But the point was, I was no saint. But I said to myself, I don't understand this. It doesn't make sense. I'm leaving school, and the principal knows. And Marmion knows, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Okay.
There's something here that I don't understand.
That said a lot. Their silence to your parents
and
said a lot.
Dale Harrow sent me an email. Dale is a guy who keeps in touch. I was in the 1966-67 class with Dale, and he's kept us in touch for over 50 years. He lives in Limerick. And when he sent me the email and your show, oh, boy, it opened up my mind, forgive me, but when I listen to the other guys, my empathy, my compassion goes out. I was not sexually abused by Marmion.
I know that.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. Yeah. I didn't even know the facts of life. A lot of us, I don't think, did.
And I think
I never talked to other boys about those things. But I just felt always uncomfortable with Marmion.
Okay.
He had me sit up in front of him in class, and the way he would mimic me and sort of, he'd flash his lips like he was sending me a kiss and all this.
Oh,
and he told me, Aer Lingus were coming to the school, you know, about careers, and I'd make a nice airline hostess. This was in front of other boys,
you
know.
Oh, my God.
But the other thing he was very good at was, he'd be on the stairs, and It's interesting. I didn't know he didn't like rugby players, but he would have made a great rugby player for his height. He was about as tall as Dara O'Malley.
Morris, I leave it at that for the time being. Can I just?
Forgive me for going.
No, you're fine. You've been eloquent.
Was there anything else you need to know?
No. But this story is ongoing. I can tell you, looking at the file we have upstairs at this stage.
I'm not going to ask you, but Fergus or Rebecca or the other lady who called. I have no contact information, and it's my fault.
Okay,
I never updated my details.
Don't worry, Morris. We'll get back onto you. Don't worry. We will.
Okay, but and all I want to do is, I'm not looking for fame. I'm not looking for.
I know that.
I just want to be helpful.
And you have been.
I agree that there should be an independent lawyer who's not a Catholic, and have an investigation. And I am frank with you. I'm going only on my memory, and there are three sides to every story. My side, the other person's side, and God only knows.
Okay. And Morris, I'm conscious you told me you're 72 this Saturday, so happy birthday to you. And I hope I sounds like you're as healthy as your wonderful, wonderful voice and your honest eloquence comes across. Thanks indeed.
And I'll say another thing to you.
Okay.
Listening to your show, I told a friend of mine, you remind me of my late friend Bob Byrne from Kilester. We were pals here for years.
Okay.
I say, this guy, Joe, I said, I could imagine myself sitting down with him with people who don't get along, and he'd be sitting there and we'd all be talking, and he has this way, and we wouldn't leave the room fighting. We'd leave understanding each other.
Maybe so. But Morris, good health to you, and kind personal regards. That's Morris Stokes in Canada. More after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
John Sheridan was a pupil in Clongowes, another Jesuit college, boarding fee paying from 1962 to 64. And Joseph Marmion was prefect then. What contact did you have with him, John?
Well, basically, I would be reiterating what a lot of people have said. He was a vile person who preyed upon people. He ran a very strict regime for punishment. Mm-hmm. I suffered under his hands for punishment beatings, where he would bring you up to his office and tell you to take your trousers down or your pants, and he would beat you on your bare backside. He was a vile person who would be hard words to describe, but he victimized people basically anyway. And
then not just the beatings, with this implement he called the pandy bat.
Yes. I told you, researcher, you know, people would ask, what's the pandy bat? The last time I saw a pandy bat was in the James Joyce Tower out in Sandy Cove. It was actually on the wall. And I said to the man in charge there, I said, do you know what that is on the wall? And he said, no. Mm. He said, I'm intrigued. He said, it's been on the wall. I said, well, James Joyce went to Clongowes, as I did.
And he went to Belvedere. He was a Jesuit boy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was indeed. And I said, that was used for punishment beatings. I said, it was manufactured in such a way that for the Jesuits, that there was actually lead in the two ends of it, and there was spring steel in it, which it made it quite an impression on either your hands or on your backside as well.
And Morris there alluded to a number of things, but including his humiliation of young boys.
He did. I mean, I told your researcher before I came on that before I did my inter-certificate, he said to me and two other guys, one of them is deceased, still one of them alive. He said to the three of us, because he nicknamed us the Three Musketeers, he said, you three guys might as well go home now with the rest of the pupils and don't bother sitting your inter-cert, because you haven't a chance of getting it. You're useless.
Good God.
So basically, I sat my inter. I got
Which
it.
Which was the junior cert in those days.
Junior cert, yeah, before your final years.
Yeah.
And I got it. I got two honours in it. And when I came back in for fifth year for picking out our subjects, each student went in to Marmion and would adjudicate what subjects would be suitable for them. So when I came into his office, he said, oh, here's Sheridan, he said, the man that didn't deserve to get the inter-cert. I said, well, Father, I did get it. And I said, I don't know whether you're aware of it, But I might as well tell you that during the Christmas holidays, I cycled from my home up to Walkinstown to do mass grinds. Yeah. Oh, so what, he said. I said, no, I said, I'm not boasting about the fact. But I said, you know, you kind of dismiss people because, and you're dismissive of me because I got the exam. And this was typical of, you know, he dismissed people, made little of people.
Humiliated people. And you know, other priests, as Andrew said, who enabled other priests. But John, this bizarre story of your partner in St. Vincent's Hospital in 1998, which is now 11 years after the Jesuits discovered he was a criminal and a paedophile, but they now had him as a chaplain in St. Vincent's private hospital, and your partner came across him. Tell us about that episode, John, briefly, please.
Well, basically, my partner went in for cancer treatment, and she was terminally ill, and she went to get confessions, mm-hmm. and I wasn't aware of the fact that Marmion was chaplain at the time, but anyway, she got a confession heard, and the priest said to her that he wouldn't grant her absolution because she was living with somebody, and he would only grant her absolution on the condition that she said that she would give an undertaking that she wouldn't live with this person when she got back out of hospital. I don't know whether he was aware that she was terminally ill, but she wasn't aware of it at the time, but I was anyway. And this was the stipulation. There was no absolution unless she gave a commitment. It was only afterwards that I discovered that
it was Marmion,
and Marmion was chaplain.
And apparently the nuns in St. Vincent's held him in high regard, John. Anyway.
Well, this is it. The people on your programme said she went to his mass and found him a very jovial, amicable kind of person. But any of the guys that went to Congo's there, I haven't heard anybody speak up about the man, and nobody positive, on your programme has come up.
That's true.
He was an evil, vile man and was let get away with it. Both when you think of what happened in three different schools, it wasn't just in one school. He was in Limerick.
In four different decades, from the 1960s to the... Okay. John, thanks indeed. That's John Sheridan.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.